There's an old joke that has been used all the time, but I first heard it used about the music business. It goes like this. How do you make $1 million in the music business? You start with $2 million. It's a good line, and it says a lot about how music is a crapshoot. Most people lose. But the joke also works because music is a place where you can lose big. If you did want to lose $1 million, then doing something with music megastars or lots of people is the way to do it. Go big or go home. And in the 90s, there was nothing bigger in music than music festivals. There was nothing riskier either. Music festivals are the highest risk venture in all of the music business. They cost $47 billion to put on. There's 47 billion moving parts. You put all your eggs into a one-day basket. And then, I imagine, you try not to shit your pants. That didn't seem to stop a number of people in the 90s putting on the brown underwear and giving it a go. Because if you could get it right, the rewards were also enormous. There was an explosion of music festivals in Australia in the 90s, in a way that was kind of uniquely Australian. It lasted well past the 90s into the next decade, and it was a high-risk, high-burnout game. But the 90s was where it started, and it would be multiple rivals trying to build something up whilst trying to take each other down. Welcome to Just Ace, a podcast about the 90s Australian alternative music scene, whatever the hell that means. This week we look at Alternative Nation, Somersault, and how the music festivals went to war. The 1995 Big Day Out was the fourth year of the Australian Travelling Music Festival. 1992 saw the Big Day Out launch in Sydney only, headlined by Nirvana. 1993, it travelled for the first time to four capital cities and was headlined by Sonic Youth and Iggy Pop. 1994 was the first time it went to Queensland as well as New Zealand. The headliners included Soundgarden, Smashing Pumpkins and Bjork. Of course, they also featured the cream of Australia's local alternative scene. 1995 was set to be another killer year. It would once again travel to six cities and feature some of the biggest bands in the world mixed with some of the hottest local acts. Britpop megastars Oasis, industrial metal kings Ministry, punk breakthroughs The Offspring were all announced. They joined a bill with UMI, The Clouds, Silverchair, Tumbleweed, Magic Dirt and more. The promoters of the Big Day Out, Vivian Lees and Ken West, had stumbled onto the magic formula. But other people were trying to create their own version of the Super Soldier Serum. One group that watched on was a trio of established promoters. They were named Michael Chugg, Michael Koppel, and Michael Gadinsky. Chugg and Gadinsky were partners in Frontier Touring, and Koppel was the head of Michael Koppel Presents. The Michaels controlled the business of touring in Australia. They had Australian touring rights with most of the big international acts. People like U2, Springsteen, Madonna, Elton John, and more came to Australia, promoted by a Michael. The Michaels have been competitive with each other over the years, but they could all separately do the maths on the Big Day Out, and they saw an opportunity. Each of the Michaels had considered doing their own version of alternative festivals, but realised that if they each put on their own day, all it would do was drive prices up for the small pool of bands and shoot each other in the foot. Better to work together on their true goal, wiping the Big Day Out off the map. The Big Day Out had managed to find a slice of the pie that the Michaels weren't serving. This new scene of alternative acts coming out of the rest of the world didn't have existing touring deals, and they preferred to work with the younger, more alternative-minded Lees and West, or their friend Steve Pavlovic, who promoted bands like Nirvana and Sonic Youth. In the highly competitive world of massive touring, the Big Day Out was a common enemy for the Michaels. They weren't sitting there thinking, oh, there's room for everyone. They wanted to take over what the Big Day Out had. That was their goal. They weren't even shy about saying it. So with their collective touring rosters and their decades of experience, the consortium of Michaels put together their own alternative music festival. At first, they went to Lollapalooza, the US touring festival that was the inspiration for the Big Day Out. They tried for a while to get the brand name, but ultimately the Americans decided to focus on themselves. That negotiation set the Michaels back a year or two, and it meant that it took till the fourth Big Day Out before they could mount a competitor. Instead, they called their festival Alternative Nation, after a term used by Lollapalooza founder Perry Farrell of Jane's Addiction's fame. They put alternative right there in the title. It was a name that was obvious about its intentions, and in some quarters, it was considered maybe too obvious. There was already a bit of a backlash to the term alternative in 1995. The lineup was Red Hot Chili Peppers, Faith No More, Violet Femmes, Live, Tool, and many others. It was a pretty strong lineup. The Red Hot Chili Peppers were one of the biggest acts in the scene. They had come from the indie side and signed to Warner Brothers for big money. And they had managed to cross over with songs like Under the Bridge, but remained strange and left of centre. Faith No More, Violet Femmes and Live were also the type of bands that had a song or two that people knew. This was the mid-90s, and the biggest alternative bands had commercial hits. There were rumours that Green Day and Stone Temple Pilots would also join the bill, but neither were officially announced. Still, it looked like Alternative Nation was going to be a strong addition to the Australian festival calendar, which is great because right from the start, the Michaels were looking to make it a yearly event. They also mimicked Lollapalooza and the Big Day Out model of making it more than just about the music. It was alternative as a lifestyle. There'd be an alt-rock exhibition, international food stores, a space for poetry, and something called an alternative market. Alternative Nation didn't try to compete with the Big Day Out in terms of dates. They let them have the January long weekend. Instead, they would stake their claim on the Easter long weekend. The festival would travel to three cities instead of six, but it would be the three biggest cities, Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane. The Big Day Out folks saw Alternative Nation as real competition. It was competition for audiences, who might decide to save their pennies for Easter. It was competition for acts, who might be offered more money from a rival. And they felt a little bitter towards bands like the Violent Femmes, who played the first Big Day Out but was now on the Alternative Nation bill. It was also a competition for sponsors. By the mid-90s, the business of alternative was getting huge and the Big Day Out was starting to feel the pressure. They had started when a band called Nirvana honoured their initial deal to play the festival for no extra money, despite blowing up and becoming the biggest band in a decade. Nirvana stayed in Australia to do extra shows after their promoter lost some money. That level of close-knit, handshake friendship of the first couple of years was gone by 1995. By then, Oasis, who was arguably the biggest band of 1995, with their billion-selling What's the Story Morning Glory album and number one hit Wonderwall, pulled out of the festival. The important radio station Triple J also pulled out as a sponsor. The lineup, Ministry, Primal Scream, Hole and others, was still strong, and they had the best of the locals. January 1995 rolled around and despite the challenges, the Big Day Out was another sold-out success. It was the year that the international music industry took notice of Australian rock. A&R men from several international labels flew in to see the best of Australian music. There was international hype around several bands. Magic Dirt, UMI and Silverchair all signed international deals because of that day. But the Big Day Out was not a guaranteed success. Things were getting harder and a new competitor was the last thing they needed. Alternative Nation went on sale a few weeks after the 1995 Big Day Out wrapped. By the time tickets went on sale, a couple of things had changed. They couldn't get the Sydney Showgrounds over Easter as it had the very famous Royal Easter Show. They tried the St. Ives Showground, but it fell through. In a last-minute scramble, the venue was moved to Eastern Creek, a racetrack on the edge of Sydney. Frontier had presented a huge Guns N' Roses concert there a couple of years earlier. Eastern Creek worked fine for Guns N' Roses, who were more suburban rock, but it was a trek for inner-city kids and not somewhere they'd been before. Even some of the organisers hated the venue. Big Day Out had always struggled to find a home in Brisbane. Alternative Nation managed to secure a venue, the Chandler Sports Complex, not a place that normally held festivals. They had to spread the show and the lineup over 2 days, so venue problems was strike one. Strike two was the cancellation of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Singer Anthony Kiedis had drug problems and the band essentially stopped. It wasn't ideal for the festival, but the rest of the lineup was still pretty strong, and they hoped that a good replacement would sort it out. But finding a replacement would be difficult. Ticket sales on day one was 50% of where they needed to be, which isn't a bad result, but it stalled after that. So where were these other ticket sales going to come from? Well, they needed a big draw card or two that would make people want to come along. In desperation, 17 days out from the first show, they paid Nine Inch Nails $700,000 to headline. That's almost $250,000 a show. Their breakthrough album, The Downward Spiral, had been released a year earlier. They were one of the biggest bands in the world, but Reznor, a difficult person at the best of times, refused to do any promotion. And not that he was in any fit shape to appear in interviews, as he was suffering from his own drug problems. And commercial radio didn't exactly embrace those abrasive singles like Closer, with all its swearing. Basically, Nine Inch Nails didn't drive ticket sales. So they paid big money to get one more last-minute act, and it was Lou Reed. He had just come off a reunion with the Velvet Underground, and was suddenly a huge draw in Europe and the US. He was playing those Velvet Underground songs again, but he was hardly a Triple J-type artist that appealed to the Big Day Out crowd. His inclusion was a last-minute attempt to try and draw an older crowd, and that failed. He didn't drive ticket sales either. It didn't help that the Australian lineup wasn't great. Alternative Nation only showcased bands that were associated with Frontier and Koppel. The acts included Def FX, in a funny period before Psychoactive Summer turned their career around, and there was Spiderbait, Regurgitator and Powderfinger, but a good year before Buy Me a Pony, Kung Fu Sing or Pick You Up turned them into alternative music stars in 1996. They did have Custard, who was about to release their breakthrough single, Apartment. It was not just a weak local lineup, it spoke to how disconnected they were from the local scene and the local crowd. When it came to the show, all the local acts were shunted off to their own smaller stage. It was a far cry from the Triple J mantra of supporting Australian and local music that fed the scene. Speaking of which, Triple J didn't really care for Alternative Nation either. So they went for the much more commercial rock station Triple M for support. They had done a great job promoting that Guns N' Roses tour, and they played music by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Green Day and Stone Temple Pilots, so it seemed like the right idea. But commercial station Triple M was also going through an identity crisis at the time. It was a network of rock radio station which had huge numbers, but rock was becoming alternative, and alternative rock was the remit of Triple J. And in the first radio survey of 1995, the radio equivalent of ratings, Triple J was ahead of Triple M. Triple M was losing audience, and they were on the wrong side of the culture battle. At the start of 1995, Triple M shed a managing director and a programming director, and they would ultimately poach Barry Chapman, the head of Triple J, to take over. Chapman would also take some of the Triple J staff, but he didn't start until July 1995. So when Alternative Nation came around at Easter, no one was steering the Triple M ship. It didn't help that after Red Hot Chili Peppers cancelled, there were really no bands that Triple M played on their radio station. They would have played Green Day and Stone Temple Pilots, but neither ended up on the bill. It had been a couple of years since Faith No More had a commercial hit, and there was nothing commercial about Tool or Primus or Pennywise. They didn't play music from the new headliners like Nine Inch Nails or Lou Reed. I mean, Alternative Nation had Ween on the lineup. It wasn't a good match for Triple M. It not only cost them a lot of publicity when their radio partner didn't care, it added to the confusion of what this event even was. Infamously, Alternative Nation had a promotion with Pizza Hut where you could get free tickets to the show with an order of some pizzas. It didn't endear them to people who had already paid full price, but they didn't want the shows to feel empty. They wanted people to come again the following year. The Michaels had a multi-year plan, and if they weren't making money in the first year, building an audience for later years might make it all worth it.
Take a trip to Alternative Nation and witness music's next generation. Nine Inch Nails, Fake No More, Violent Femmes, Primus, Ice-T and Body Count, Tool, L7, The Tea Party, Ween, Live, Flaming Lips, plus Australia's hottest acts and special guest Lou Reed. Alternative Nation, Eastern Creek Raceway, Easter Saturday, presented by Triple M on SoundCloud.
When Easter came around and the shows were being set up, the promoters were hoping for walk-ups. They did a round of promotion telling people that tickets were available. Come and see some fantastic acts for a good price and enjoy the day. Buy a ticket at the gate. But that didn't work out either. Look, to me, God is just a Sidewinder single, but it's hard to not think that the 1997 Sidewinder single wasn't somehow mad at Alternative Nation, because it rained at all three Alternative Nation shows. The rains hit exactly on the days that the festivals were held. If the whole tour was moved back one day, it would have been fine. As it rained in Sydney, Melbourne looked fine, and when they got to Melbourne, the skies opened. It wasn't just a bit of rain either. It was non-stop, low visibility, turn your headlights on as you drive, your foot sinks into the mud kind of rain. No one was rocking up to buy tickets at the gate, especially at venues that music fans didn't like going to anyway, in the middle of nowhere, as Eastern Creek was. Some people who had tickets didn't even turn up. In the end, Alternative Nation lost around $2 million. That's a $500,000 loss a day. It wasn't just because the ticket sales were bad, the costs had blown out. Managing a festival was different from a big stadium show. Every single one of the bands had their own needs, and they put every show back to back without accounting for moving this massive amount of people and their gear overnight. The extra logistical work was something that the Big Day Out team had learned through doing it a few years. It was alien to the Michaels, and then a million of that loss was pretty much the fee for Nine Inch Nails and Lou Reed. Ironically, the reviews were good. Reading the immediate reviews in street press and rock mags, it sounded like a pretty good day of music. People got to see some great bands, which was what it's all about. Faith No More were apparently the highlight. There wasn't mentions about it being empty. Despite the rain, it sounds like the people who were there had a good time. And it was the first year, and maybe it was a starting point. But behind the scenes, a lot of money was lost. For the three Michaels, it was the biggest loss of money in one go of their careers. The Big Day Out got lucky with Alternative Nation. They dodged a bullet. But there was another shot fired at the Big Day Out, and this one came from the back. Steve Pavlovic had moved from Canberra and had moved on from being the manager of the Plunderers to being the Australian music promoter for some of the biggest bands in the world. He had brought Nirvana to Australia. He brought the Lemonheads to Australia, the Beastie Boys, Fugazi, and many others. For the Big Day Out, he booked important headliners like Sonic Youth, Mudhoney, and Hole. But he didn't feel like he was getting his piece of the action. He wasn't making money, and his bands were not getting paid very much. And the Big Day Out wasn't his, and it certainly wasn't his vision. There's two views here. The Big Day Out people figured that Pav's bands wanted to play the festival, and the massive publicity they got from playing the Big Day Out turned them into stars. And there's an element of truth there, that the Big Day Out was a huge platform for new bands. But it also has the smell of the old playing for no money but for exposure. On the other hand, Pav believed that he helped make the Big Day Out what it was. He had brought these impossibly cool bands to Australia, who wouldn't be here without him. And without that cool factor, the Big Day Out would not be the success that it was. This was kind of true as well. I would give Pav that the bands that he booked helped set the scene of the Big Day Out, which was that American grunge East Coast scene. It never felt like they had a strong line into the hottest British bands. I would say that for the Australian alternative music scene, from Triple J down, it was heavily influenced by American acts for the start of the 90s, whilst fantastic British music got lost. And that was kind of because of Pav, who talked them into coming to Australia. All those bands who could say they supported Nirvana in Australia for an international press release was kind of because of Pav. Tumbleweed working with Mudhoney's Mark Arm, or UMI working with Sonic Youth's Lee Ronaldo, and Half a Cow's connection with the Lemonheads was all part of how the American grunge scene was sewed into the Australian indie scene at the time. Pav mightn't have done any of the sewing, but he supplied a lot of the thread. So Pav wanted a bigger piece of the action. The Big Day Out said no, and Pav decided, stuff it, I'm going to start my own festival. If Alternative Nation wanted to be a challenge to the Big Day Out, they at least knew that they weren't going to go head on. They avoided the clash of dates as much as they could, moving it months away. They worked on completely different bands, bands that had deals with that the Big Day Out weren't bidding for. Not so for Pav. Pav would call his festival Somersault. It would be held over New Year's Eve 1995 into January 1996, in the same summer as Big Day Out 1996. The last Somersault was 2 weeks before the first Big Day Out. The story goes there was a lot of fighting between the two camps. There was accusations of dirty tactics. Pav accused the Big Day Out folks of trashing his name to potential venues. Big Day Out's Ken West heard some of the names that Pav was considering for the festival and went ahead and registered them for himself. Pav in turn managed to book Big Day Out's regular Melbourne venue. They fought over staff. Independent publicists and photographers who didn't know who to be loyal to were caught in the middle. There was also only so many lighting rigs and stages available. They of course fought over the bands. On the bill for Somersault was the Beastie Boys, Beck, and the recently formed Foo Fighters, and former Big Day Out headliners Sonic Youth and Violet Femmes. Pav tried to secure Rage Against the Machine on the eve of releasing their second album, Evil Empire. But they had been courted by the Big Day Out as well, who ultimately outbid Pav. They both fought over Rancid, who refused to choose sides, and did both festivals. As much as Somersault came from wanting to compete with the Big Day Out, it was designed to be different. Notably, it was smaller. It was only two stages and less than half the number of acts of the Big Day Out. It was way more targeted to Pav's tastes. He didn't rely on any outside bookers. The lineup was all his friends, many of them he had toured before. But apart from the Beastie Boys, they didn't really have a big headliner that would bring people outside of the Triple J crowd. and the Beastie Boys already toured in 1992 and 1994. The rest of it, Sonic Youth, Pavement, Bikini Kill, were all cool, critically acclaimed bands, but not bands with hits. But this was the point. Pav wanted to build something that was more exclusive. It was an experience for people to try. Summersell had space for activism groups to talk to people, an art exhibition, and a separate night to celebrate the US dance label MoWax. Alternative Nation tried and arguably failed to reflect what this new alternative scene wanted. It was too broad and too obvious. Summersault kind of was going in the opposite direction. It was too inside baseball. Summersault was held at some pretty small venues, but still it was far from sold out. A music festival's costs remain the same whether you're sold out or half full. Reports were that the numbers were okay and that it didn't look empty, but it wasn't anywhere near enough. On the other hand, the costs were astronomical. Pav organised for bands to stay in nice hotels and they travelled by boat and helicopters, not just the headliners. Some of the smaller bands had never played a show outside their home where they weren't sleeping on a sofa, and now they were getting room service. It's a nice gesture, but an expensive one. Plus, there was just the many logistics of running a festival that, like the Michaels, Pav and his team didn't anticipate their first time out. Pav lost a lot of money on Summersault, but he managed to take a chunk out of the big day out. 1996 was the first year it didn't sell out, and they just managed to hold on. Their lineup was very weak internationally. They had paid big money for Rage Against the Machine. Peter Farrell of Jane's Addiction and Lollapalooza had a new band called Pornos for Pyros, but the new band of the guy that was once in a bigger band wasn't itself a big band. Also on the bill was British it band Elastica, who was on their first album and had a couple of minor hits, and The Prodigy, a couple of years before Fat of the Land made them mega famous. The latter would headline the dance tent called The Boiler Room. Arguably, though, it was Rage Against the Machine that saved them. But their local lineup was once again incredible. Nick Cave headlined, and Kylie Minogue joined the set, and they performed Where the Wild Roses Grow, their hit duet. The coming together of Australia's most critically acclaimed and arguably best singer-songwriter, and Nick Cave, was big news. Kylie meant that beyond Triple J, the commercial tabloids gave a shit about the big day out. Add to that Tism, Tumbleweed, Spiderbait, Custard, Ammonia, Shehad, Even, Powderfinger, and dozens more. Big Day Out just always won the local lineup battle. As everyone was trying to stitch together a couple of stages, the Big Day Out seemed to bury you with bands you heard on Triple J, local or otherwise. Whereas Summersault only had a couple of Australian acts, and that wasn't really the point of that festival. But after several years of success, the Big Day Out was taking hits, and it almost fell over completely in 1996. So they decided to do one more, 1997, and then call it a day. The Michaels and Pav had both announced that their festivals would be multi-year affairs and that were built to last. To press, both had said that they would be more than happy to fill any gap that the Big Day Out leaves behind. But neither Alternative Nation nor Summersault had a second year. The Michaels were divided over whether to continue. They had done all the hard work of the first year, establishing themselves and showing that it could be done. They had terrible luck and made a couple of iffy choices, but there was no reason to suspect that year two wouldn't improve on all that. But on the other hand, it was a lot of money to put on the line again. They intended to put the Big Day Out out of business, and that certainly didn't happen. The Michaels, usually rivals and individuals, couldn't agree on a way to continue. So Alternative Nation just died. And after Summersault, it was claimed that Pav almost went bankrupt. What did happen was that he had to give up his label, Fellaheen, which he ran with ex-Waterfront person Steve Stavrakis. He continued doing touring, but his success would lay elsewhere, in a label called Modular, but that's something for later. The Big Day Out team worked on a smaller festival instead for 1998's Australia Day period. Called Starbait, it would travel to five cities with a dance-focused lineup of The Prodigy, Black Grape, Regurgitator, Sonic Animation and more. But tickets didn't sell, and the show was ultimately cancelled altogether. But the Big Day Out after their break in 1998 seemed to come back renewed and with more ambition. The 1999 show moved out of Sydney's inner city showground to the new showgrounds being set up for the Sydney 2000 Olympic Games, which was in the suburbs. It was a big concrete valley, but they knew that they were staying there and every year they'd make it their own. They started doing CD compilations and making a cut of those sales. They grew their staff tenfold and ran the longest running, most successful music festival in Australian history. My first Big Day Out was that 1999 one. It might have been the first time I could actually go, but I knew about it for years. I knew intimately all the bands I missed from previous years from being too young. I read all about it in magazines. Maybe I saw the odd sideshow. People around me would describe to me how cool Teenage Fan Club looked. I still remember the description. Now I could finally see it myself. I went to the Big Day Out every year after that until I left Australia. It didn't matter the lineup. I hated Limp Bizkit and I hated Metallica and I still went along. I came to love having the yearly thing that I did. I knew where the lily pad would be every year. I knew where the quiet t-shirt store was, or the good toilets. The last couple of times I just got the train there on my own. I knew my friends would be there and where to find them. Marketing people would call this brand loyalty or something. But if I look at what happened to music festivals in the mid-90s, I wonder if the Big Day Out survived simply because of that. Brand loyalty, and the fact that they had a bunch of people who liked what they do and came back. That there were a few years before everyone else. Why go to a new festival in a new location where you have no idea where the good toilets are? And I guess the Big Day Out was just good. Being first only gets you so far, and if they weren't doing just about everything right for their crowd, someone would have stepped in. But they didn't, and they tried. People who I knew who worked at the Big Day Out worked their asses off. Even if it wasn't your thing, you have to concede that what they built was strong enough that it couldn't be knocked over. It wasn't always easy. The death of a young girl at a Big Day Out in 2001 was a turning point. But still, the Big Day Out remained the biggest music festival in Australia. They sometimes even had to put on a second Sydney show. They not only survived the challenges of the mid-90s, but they thrived.
How you doing, everybody?
1999, the year the Big Day Out returned to the music calendar. It was the year Christian Democratic crusader Fred Nile protested against the inclusion of goth rocker Marilyn Manson.
He's got a sexual thing too.
It was the year of superstar DJ Fatboy Slim, and it was the year that fun-loving criminals had it out with Underworld. 1999 also saw Australian bands Regurgitator, Powderfinger and the Super Jesus take to the main stage. And it was the year Korn provided the metal and Courtney Love provided the nudity.
There were plenty of festivals in Australia, but they were camping ones or one-day single-city ones. There were very few that would challenge the Big Day Out in mounting these national touring festivals. The Brisbane Music Festival Livid did Sydney and Melbourne in 2002, but then never tried it again. The Force Festival in Victoria expanded into Tasmania, but for a good decade or so, the Big Day Out ruled. But that didn't last. The last Big Day Out was in 2014. By then, Vivian Lees had left, as did many of the other key staff like Sahara Herald. Ken West partnered with the US events company called C3, who managed Lollapalooza. Alternative Nation had tried to partner with Lollapalooza 2 decades earlier. West ultimately sold his stake to AJ Matter, who founded the competing festival Soundwave. Both the founders were gone. There were plans to go bigger. There were plans to partner with international festivals, but none of that worked. I have thoughts on what killed the Big Day Out. There was definitely mismanagement. Blur infamously announced that they weren't headlining in 2014 just weeks before the tour started and pointed fingers at the organisers as their reasons. There were also too many competitors. I would say that I don't know what made the Big Day Out different or special by 2014. Many of the headliners had played previous years, and things like the lily pad came and went, New Zealand stopped happening, and it kind of went into a slow decline. Reports of the 2014 year was that it was half full. Alternative Nation lost 2 million with 4 shows, and reports later emerged that the 2014 Big Day Out lost 10 to 12 million over 6 shows. So how do you make $1 million in the music business? Well, you start with 13 million and you do what the Big Day Out did in 2014. In the aftermath, the people involved in the Big Day Out went bankrupt and C3 announced that 2015 wasn't going ahead. And then it just never came back. Of course, I never got to go to any of those great festivals in 95 or 96, but looking back on the old reports, especially the big posters with all those band names, it sounded really exciting. Just look at those names. Beastie Boys, Sonic Youth, Nine Inch Nails, Rage Against the Machine, all in their prime. Add to that bands that were bubbling under like Elastica, Ween, Pavement, Beck and more. And then add to that another 50 or so incredible Australian bands from UMI, The Cruel Sea, Silverchair, TISM, Spiderbait, Regurgitator and much more. The platform that these mega festivals supplied for Australian music cannot be understated. For many of these bands, the Big Day Out was the biggest crowd they would ever play to. The huge publicity of getting on the bill meant that every music fan in Australia knew your name. All these festivals lost a lot of money between them, but a lot of people got to see some pretty great music in those years. And what a way to spend a day, surrounded by people just like you, getting to see like 20 bands, and if you didn't live in Sydney or Melbourne, the festival kind of came to you. One final thought. All of this worked great with alternative music, whatever the hell that means. Festivals are great for a young crowd, and the alternative scene in the 90s was young. Festivals suit bands who can play live and make a racket, as opposed to pop stars. Let's face it, you can never hear the vocals at a festival. It's not a place for R&B harmonies or big voice divas. For international acts, who made their money touring, it was the best way to come to Australia. The festival meant you got to play in every city, and it made the cost of that long flight worth it. It was also a great way to spend the Northern Hemisphere winter. Escape to the sunshine and heat of Australia for a few weeks in January. And it was a community. This alternative crowd liked coming together. Of course there were dance festivals and metal festivals and punk festivals, but alternative was kind of bigger than all of those, so these festivals could be massive the way a single genre festival could not. These alternative kids were open to new sounds and new bands. They wanted to explore the whole lineup. For me, and for a generation, going to an alternative music festival was the biggest day in the calendar. Everyone would be there, and you would spend weeks picking out the right band t-shirt to wear. It was the one time that we got to be who we really wanted to be. These music-loving fans, ignoring that the outside world existed at all. Ken West sadly passed away in 2022. He was writing a book that is apparently finished. Some chapters are online, and they are hilarious. It's exactly the kind of Big Day Out book I want. I hope that book comes out. Double J did an excellent behind the scenes of the Big Day Out as a podcast. They get incredible access. The final episode in particular about the end of the Big Day Out is one of the best things I've ever heard. If you love stories about how crazy some people's jobs can get, go check it out. Alternative Nation and the Michaels have their story told in a book called The Promoters, written by Stuart Coop. Pav told some of his story in an arts exhibition recently at Sydney's Powerhouse Museum. Somersault was a big part of it. I wish they had some sort of tie-in book. This isn't the end of festivals and this podcast. There's one more chapter next season. And how one festival didn't need international headliners at all. Let's end on some music. The highest billed Australian band on the 1995 Big Day Out was The Clouds. It had been a couple of years since their album Thunderhead, and their label didn't want them making a new album yet, so it was all a mess. But there was a Big Day Out edition of Thunderhead that featured their EP Beetroot as well. In fact, there was a few Big Day Out editions of albums where touring bands would add a bonus disc to a recent album and get it back into stores. I treasure my Big Day Out version of Teenage Fan Club's Grand Prix album. But the new release for The Clouds that year was the Beetroot EP, and the single off it was called Boy of Air. So to end, here's The Clouds with Boy of Air. So thank you for listening to this very first episode of the new season of Just Ace. It feels great to get it going again. So the end bit of the podcast is where I talk to you about how you can support me. You know how it works with stuff like this. If you can and you want to, there's a way to support content creators like myself. What's new this year is the book. Yes, Just Ace is a book, and it's essentially the scripts from the first two seasons rewritten into a book. You can relive the first two seasons in your own time without my voice. There's the Patreon as well. Thank you to all the patrons for your usual ongoing support. And there's a tipping service called Buy Me a Coffee. You can just leave me a tip with no strings attached. You can buy merch on Redbubble where I have t-shirts or bags or stickers that have the podcast logo or the book cover art. Or there are no-cost ways to support me, like leaving me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, or leaving me a review on Amazon if you buy a book, or simply sharing the podcast and telling a friend. Every little bit helps. I'll say more about each one in the end bits of future episodes as well. Links for everything are in the description, including how to get to the website, socials, and how to get in contact with me. Okay, next week, I look at a topic I probably shouldn't be talking about.
Hi, this is John from Fove's Other Best People. We review each and every song from legendary Australian rock group, The Fove's. From misguided modelling career to Dog's Other Best People. From Celebrate the Failure to Simon Tahiti. Are you a fan of The Fove's? Give Fove's Other Best People a spin. Available from wherever you get your podcasts and at fovespodcast.com.